back to another edition of The Exchange. I'm joined, as always, with my co-host, Blake Doyle. We have a pretty big lineup today for the podcast. We have an interview with probably one of both of our biggest mentors throughout the years, Alan Andrews, and also some sparks have been flying over the past couple of days in terms of COVID. Any comments on that, Blake?
Comments on COVID? Well, look, I'm happy the economy's opening up. We're inching toward June 1st, and we're going to see a lot of pent-up enthusiasm hit restaurateurs, which desperately need supports. The most recent flare-up, which is really controversial, I'm shocked at how polarized people are on this issue. And I have frequented a few local retailers where there's some traffic coming in and out. And I've asked people in the counters, what are people saying about this issue? And, you know, I'm kind of surprised, actually. It's pretty uniform, at least the small sample that I've touched base with. People, I think, want to really protect their borders and limit potential exposure of people coming to PEI. And that would be in contrast with what, you know, the economy would suggest is required, which is external influence and external capital. So I think it's a very polarized issue. I think this is one that's probably not going to go away anytime soon. It's probably going to, you know, follow all leaders and all parties to the polls, whenever that might happen to be. What do you think? Are you hearing anything?
Of course, I have an opinion. The issue at hand is that June 1st, the provincial government, PEI government, is going to allow cottagers to come that don't live on PEI, but their second residence is in PEI, that they can come and isolate and do whatever, but they can come and spend their summer here starting June 1st. So the biggest issue with this, from an island perspective, is that we're allowing people that may live in the States, may live out West, may live in Ontario, may live wherever, that they're allowed to come and drive to PEI, self-isolate, and then spend the summer on PEI. The biggest issue that I see of it is that, yes, they may pay double property tax, but they don't pay income tax. They're not contributing as much to the economy other than what they'd have to get for groceries and whatnot. But it's kind of like, okay, we're giving the people with more money, maybe the retirees, the cottagers, the people that own these properties, that we're giving them the opportunity before we're giving more so essential or people that actually want to get out and do whatever. And the biggest one thing that also was kind of sparked in suggestion or comment was that Blaine Higgs was never informed. So the Premier of New Brunswick was never informed, and he said that that could jeopardize the bubble idea between PEI and New Brunswick. So I think it might have been a rush decision, and obviously it's like putting toothpaste back into the tube. You can't reverse it. So it's definitely polarizing for Islanders and others that are just commenting on it. I've seen a post on either Facebook or Twitter that had somewhere upwards of 600 shares basically saying, why are you letting non-Islanders come just because they have a house or cottage here?
Well, maybe the era of collaboration, at least interprovincially, is coming to an end. I saw I think Sonny Glant posted that maybe he's not going to be as collaborative, or his party's not going to be as collaborative going forward. But look, governments are elected to make decisions. Maybe from time to time, I think it's fair to say that they often don't always make the best decisions, and then they have to respond and react. This one, I'm actually astounded at the polarization. And maybe it's not even polarized. I think, as you've described, it's there's a lot of people that want to keep things tight. Now, I do have colleagues of mine in other provinces, some of whom intend to come to PEI and have investments in PEI. They're restricted from doing that, and they very much feel that the province shouldn't be isolated. It needs to be opened up. So the perspective outside of PEI is probably very different, and I'm sure there's a very strong lobby of people who've made financial investment and have residences that want to get to their properties. You know, Ontario, Quebec, they resisted that for a little while with their cottage goers, but that's opened up. I don't know if you can suspend the economy permanently. You know, I guess government has an obligation to maintain public health and safety and the protection of their citizens. This is a tough one. I don't think there's a good outcome, but I am going to always defer to the necessity to maintain the economy and to keep, you know, activity occurring. If that means opening the borders, then that's a consequence that, you know, we've got accelerated vaccine, but we cannot close the economy. We're not big enough to maintain an economy independently. So big, tough decision, bold stance was taken. And I think the government's feeling the repercussions of that today.
And I've mentioned to you before that I've been on the other end of the side. I've been on the government side when they put out a maybe not so incentivizing decision, and that we get some backlash from it. So I don't want to say I sympathize with government, but I understand what they're coming from and what they might be feeling today. I think the biggest thing is for the Islanders who the lower, not lower scale, but the median income to low income, that they might feel as though, okay, well, you're letting these people with that are obviously have a little more money. If they have a second residence, they might be retired, whatever the case may be. You're letting them have free will, free run. But here I am at home. I'm unemployed. I have to look after my child now because kindergarten or daycares aren't open. And so I think they're probably feeling a little more pressure from this. They're saying, why aren't you taking care of me first? And you're worrying about these people that don't even live on PEI. So I feel I understand both sides, and I understand the cottager's perspective of wanting to get to PEI. If I live somewhere else, I'd want to rush to PEI too, because it's, first of all, it's beautiful, and it's obviously a lot safer, and our COVID cases are under control. But yeah, it's the game of politics. There's never a right answer, and clearly this one's leaning more on the no side than the yes side.
It's a tough call. I see. I guess that this is what we've elected officials to make these kind of tough decisions. I guess one thing you can look at, Sam, is the businesses that rely on external people coming to visit. So that's partially the tourism industry. It's even people like our guest today, Alan Andrews. I mean, Alan is a substantial contributor to the economy by recruiting people who want to come to his programming here on PEI. I forget the numbers, but it's substantial, like 80%.
85%, yeah, it was high.
So that's a big group of people coming to the island. Many of those just won't be able to because they're international, but they're not allowed to under the provision of this change. But there's a lot of businesses. They've got a short window to make their impact. And when you don't have a free and open economy, they're impacted. You know, that does affect everybody in the medium term. But what I do see coming out of this pandemic is a real, and it's like this polarization, is going to be a separation on a whole bunch of levels. This is one example where people get very firm in their opinion. And when you put your personal health or your family's health at risk, people get very passionate. But I think we've seen some friction between groups that are not engaged in the labor market and maybe government employees who are. I think there's going to be a whole bunch of different pivot points and battlegrounds where there's going to be friction. And this is just one more where there's underlying friction. Now that a public decision has been made, that friction is kind of bubbling to the surface. I think that's a negative and unfortunate consequence of this pandemic, but I think there's a whole bunch of flashpoints. This is just one more.
Definitely. And it did like it was only a couple weeks ago that it was a year since the government was sworn in, the cabinet was sworn in. So clearly maybe the honeymoon period's over, and now we're, obviously it's different when we're in a pandemic, but still the idea of, all right, you can do nothing wrong the first year. After that, we'll see what happens. Like, we're going to judge you on a case by case basis. And I think it's clearly obvious with this and what will happen in the future too.
Well, speaking of judging government, Sam, we've got the legislature opening up in less than a week, and a year in government, I think there's been 8 legislative days that the House has been in session. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interest. This could be a very long session. Do you think government will stay in the legislature for a long period of time to debate issues, or do you think they're just going to get in pass some necessary bills?
Their plan to happen is that they're going to do the necessary stuff the first couple of days and then wait and then like go out and then maybe come back in towards the end of June. I don't think they'll sit very long right away because this might spark some debate that they will be in longer, but I think they just want to get in and go and make sure they can spend the money where they need to and then come back whenever it's a little safer. I did see pictures of the legislature actually. It's very spread out. So where the gallery is, everyone's 6 feet apart, and it's they used every square inch of the legislature, the actual room they sit in. So I'm sure we'll see. Well, in a week's time, we'll see that what's going on there and what's happening. But I think overall, it'll be a quick and dirty session to kind of make sure they can pass the bills to spend the money where they have to in an emergency situation.
Well, in advance of this opening of the legislature, we're going to have another guest on next week that's going to talk about the politics and the environment and what's happening. It's a seasoned person, actually, who's got great insights, and look forward to hosting that next week just before the legislative session opens up. Lots on the go in the exchange. We're busy, pandemic period.
Our correspondents have been working 24/7. So just to change gears, one pretty big economic and actually e-commerce announcement the other day was that Facebook is introducing Facebook Shops, which is essentially Shopify right on Facebook. And since Facebook owns Instagram, it'll be right on Instagram too. So I think this will be a, a very, obviously they probably were preparing all this background e-commerce type deal, but now that COVID happened, they're implementing it. And I think this is going to completely take over the market. So I don't know if you've heard much about it, Blake, but just the idea that for the Facebook crowd is more so maybe the middle age to senior population that would be more on Facebook. And then the Instagram, they have a complete control of that, is more the younger demographic. So they're really touching all areas. And then you could shop right on your social media.
Well, you can see this is clearly the way that the economy is moving. Everything is digitized. It's online. It's virtual. It's e-commerce. The companies that are doing well are the ones that have adapted to the pandemic, environment. Even the technology stocks, like the NASDAQ, is pretty much back up to its all-time highs. It's very close, within striking distance. It's primarily dominated by a handful of companies that are pushing this up. And when you look at what's happening on e-commerce and the dominance of some of these firms, in a different environment, there may be antitrust kind of considerations because of the power that these organizations have. So I do watch that with interest. I think it's undeniable the force that some of these companies have, including Facebook, and it's going to really limit some of the potential of smaller guys. Now, something like Facebook is empowering smaller retailers. So where other companies don't do that, and I saw, Walmart were on CNBC yesterday, the CEO talking about their acquisition of Jet.com, which I think was about $4 billion and a questionable investment, short time ago. But the benefit that infrastructure provided Walmart has really allowed them to participate more fully in this pandemic e-commerce space. So, yeah, when you see these big heavyweight companies that have such dominance, like Facebook, starting to inhabit platforms in the short run, it might empower adaptive local companies that use this as a platform. But in the medium term, it may cut them out. And that's what you've seen Amazon, very selectively promote their products versus the ones that smaller retails might be promoting. And it's challenging to compete with organizations of that scale. So big move, progressive move in the short run. Medium term, it's probably not going to be great for small enterprise.
No, and I think the thing is, just to touch on the privacy perspective, obviously Facebook's been in some hot water before about maybe not being as honest and open about their things. But the average person, they're on Facebook 5 hours a day and they don't care about the privacy. They're nosy, maybe they want to know what's going on. But if they're spending that much time on Facebook and you can introduce a shopping feature, I think it's going to be a tremendous success for Facebook.
Now, they do have a marketplace. I think there's a Kijiji function that they have presently. So this is just another extension of their, reach into the e-commerce space.
Exactly. Anyways, speaking of the economy opening up, you've recently announced through one of your companies, Island Recruiting, that we're doing a bit of a special. Do you want to touch on that?
Well, I thought it was a pretty innovative idea. In fact, internally in our organization, we were very pleased to take to benefit from the CEWS, the Canadian Emergency Wage Subsidy. And for any employers who aren't aware of that, that's a 75% rebate in payroll. And the idea is really, how do you keep people engaged? And in the States, I think there's about 2.2 million people employed by zombie companies. So these are companies that are so debt laden that they probably will never recover. But it is important to keep people employed. So I don't think we're a zombie company, Sam, but I think the CEWS has really been a benefit. So what I wanted to do in justification to help jumpstart the economy was to pass along the savings that we're being benefited by. So we're getting 75% rebate on our team for a short period of time. How do we pass that on to the market, allow people to get a discount on our services? So that was really the intention. There's been people who've questioned the intention. It's quite a funny thing, but really it's a great opportunity. I think we're demonstrating the same leadership that the federal government have taken to implement this wage subsidy. We're, matching that with a 75% reduction in our recruitment services for the next 2 quarters. I think it's a great thing and encourage people to take advantage of it and others to match it. We need to kickstart things. So let's make it easier for people to engage. And we want people to rehire, retrain, engage new employees, and we want to help support that.
I agree, and I think it was a great idea when you kind of mentioned it, and I think it's going to be harder to find good staff, so outsource recruitment is definitely the way to go in terms of that, especially with all these people on CERB. You kind of have to get a professional to do it instead of just having the mom and pop shop try to recruit someone they hope to get, having a professional side to do it is a lot more streamlined, and you'll find better candidates. So anyways, we can touch on that more at later date, and feel free to reach out to either Blake or I if you want some more information on Island Recruiting's 75% off recruitment services. But yeah, that, I think it's a great idea to kind of help promote and kickstart the economy.
That's innovative. So it's I guess we could do another advertisement on, you know, there's no artificial flavors. There's, but it is, I think
gluten
it's a great,
free.
Yeah. No salt, no sodium. But it's an opportunity. I encourage people to take advantage. We just want to pass on the benefit that we feel that we've been able to participate in. I think it is a great program and we want to extend that. So.
Certainly.
But let's talk about what we have on today. We've got a great guest and somebody that has really steered your hockey career.
Yeah. And I made midget AAA all because of this. Today. So Alan Andrews, who has always been one of my biggest mentors and kind of always a positive encouragement at whatever I do, whether that was hockey as a young person or now in more of my professional life, he's always been there to boost me and give me guidance and give me advice on whatever I ask him about. But yeah, so basically we asked Alan about everything from start to finish on the hockey school, about kind of why he thinks the way he does and why he's a continual learner, a lifelong learner. And I think that's important in whether you're in business, hockey, life, you have to always be willing to learn and adapt. And Alan is a great case study of that.
Well, if you look at people, I'm sure are very familiar with the types of athletes that have come through his program, both male and female, at the highest levels of success in the sport. But it's not just that athletics that Alan is focused on teaching. I mean, he's creating citizens and he's creating contributors to society well beyond just their athletic. And many people are blessed with athleticism. Some, you know, go through his programs and increase their athleticism and become very successful. But boy, the thing that I'm most impressed with is how he is teaching young people how to become contributors and how to, you know, achieve what their potential is and how to become better citizens. It's really a great program, and I think that's the element that you don't really appreciate until you've gone through the program or you've seen people go through the program. And that was great to touch on as well.
Definitely. So we will turn it over to our interview with Alan Andrews, and we will talk to you soon. So we're here today with no stranger to both hockey players and Prince Edward Islanders. He's been coined the hockey professor, the hockey prof on Twitter. And he's been doing it for probably the last four decades and probably longer than that in terms of growing and coaching hockey players. We're joined with Alan Andrews today. Thanks for coming on, Alan.
No problem. It's a privilege. Privilege to be here, Sam.
Yeah, it's great. Great to have you on, Alan. You've been, you had a tremendous impact, not just on athletes, but on the economy. I mean, what you've grown in 40 years and the types of people you've attracted, the type of investment you've attracted to PEI isn't recognized, but you've had some great players pass through your program, and people such as Stephen McPhail, I think, is one of your earlier people who participated in the program. Tell us a little bit, Alan, about how this started and where it came from. I know you've got a pretty interesting path to get to growing an organization as large as you have.
I was a teacher in the early 60s, a phys ed teacher. I started the program for the City Elementary Schools in Charlottetown. And then I went back to UNB to finish a phys ed degree, and then I come on with the Department of Education. So I was working with them and coaching, always volunteer coaching on the side since 1960, actually. And I just felt that there was something I could do different and maybe make an input into the hockey on PEI. So we took 30 kids and worked with them for 3 years and developed a program, met with sports scientists. And what I wanted to do was give it to hockey PEI. And at that time, they weren't ready for it. So we just kept it going, and it turned out to be a hockey school. So, but I didn't really mean to start a hockey school. I wanted to whatever. And I saw that it was making a difference. And then after 4 or 5 years, I had to make a choice, stay with government or, you know, and I love my job with government because of youth and fitness, but I had to make a choice, and I made it. And it wasn't easy because I was doing the thing I loved to do. And then I had to learn some business skills so I could learn to keep it going. And that was the big challenge.
So Sam and I are both graduates of your program. So we've both gone through the growth program. Maybe Sam's been a longer contributor or participant than I was, but you know, I've got kids involved now. You've had a pretty substantial impact in the community. I'm sure you've had some rough patches as well as you've kind of gone through this growth. But tell us a little bit about the size of the organization, the types of programming that you have, and if you've encountered challenges, how you overcame them.
Well, right now, last year we had, I think, 25 countries or 20 countries involved, and 2,500 students, and about 80 to 85% are out of province. So they usually come for 7 or 8 days and bring their families. And so that's a significant impact on the economy for sure. But they come, number one, not just for the hockey school. They come for the person development. And that's very obvious. We make up front, we tell them that, you know, this is their main goal, is to hockey is sort of a hook. I think we do pretty good at hockey skills, and we surround ourselves with really bright young people like Brad McKenzie and my son Josh and Paul Drew. All those guys they care about young people, and they're very bright. And so I learned a long time ago, when you're limited in your abilities, you should surround yourself with people smarter than yourself. And that's been probably one of the secrets to our success.
I follow the same mantra. You can see Sam is with me, and that's the exact same. I follow the same. Maybe I learned it from Anders. But Sam, you've been involved with the program for quite a while. What are some of your fondest sort of experiences going through the...
So I guess like it was a kind of cool story is that Alan actually, you actually posted a picture on Twitter not long ago of you coached my dad when he was in Pee Wee. And then when I was probably 5 or 6 years old, I wasn't a very good skater. And that would have been the first summer of my camp. So probably for the next 5 to 6 years, I went to camp with Alan and the whole staff for that matter. And then I also played spring hockey. So I played Riptide. And the biggest thing, like, obviously I developed my skills and I was considered, at the time, I guess, a pretty good hockey player. I could skate anyways. But from there, I was able to meet some of the, like, lifelong friends. Like, I still talk to people's parents that, like, teammates of mine from, let's say, when I was a novice, when I was 8 or 9 years old, I still have talks with their parents to say, hey, Sam, how are you doing? You remember this when we won the tournament? We had a really good team at the time, so it was obviously something to look forward to. But the personal growth in terms of over the hockey has been the biggest thing, because like we mentioned before, and I'm sure this is why Alan is able to be recognized so much, is because of the citizens that are produced through the good standing citizens that are produced through the hockey school and good people. But I think probably my fondest memory, it would have been, and it just kind of came up that I remembered, is when Joel Ward retired. Joel Ward was actually one of the instructors at the camp when I went when I was a kid. So I was having Joel Ward tie my skates before he was in the NHL. So those kind of memories, and also winning championships with the Riptide teams, the spring hockey, and then having the friends from that I still talk to this day, are definitely the fondest memories that Alan's hockey program has been able to produce. And even having, when I was, I think I would have been probably 8 or 9 through Riptide, and Alan, I think you and Josh actually coached our team that year. So it was kind of cool to say, okay, well, the Alan Andrews was my hockey coach for a season.
Well, you know what? I'm not sure that the is appropriate, because I realize that the longer I work, the more I realize I have to learn a lot more than others already know. So, you know, it's always a process of learning, and you have to keep doing that. But you're a pretty delightful fella, Sam, and I always smile when I think about you. And I think that's... one of the great rewards for me is watching you guys move on, do something great with your life. And I take a lot of interest in just watching people online and reading the papers and, you know, those kinds of things. Those are the rewards of any teacher, I think, is that they want to see their students grow and do great things with their lives.
Now, and I think you've touched a lot of people, certainly myself. I have never had a hockey career. I still play. I think that's an accomplishment. Now, you've had a lot of really successful players come through your program, and when you go into your environment, your walls are full of people who show their gratitude for what they've learned through the growth program. Is there any individuals that come to mind as far as, you know, what their ethics might have been like when they went through your program at a younger age and what they became as professional athletes?
Yeah, no, I get two or three. You may be surprised. One boy is came with cystic fibrosis, and he wasn't supposed to live till he was 5. He wasn't supposed to live till he was 10. He wasn't supposed to live till he was 15. And he came and he played hockey as long as he could. He's from Stephenville Crossing, Newfoundland, and he had to quit because his body couldn't take it. And but he went to school and got a degree. His first year, he said he had a great time, but he spent 4 months in the hospital. And then he went on to get a master's in aquaculture. And he had to have a double lung transplant. He almost passed away. But he fought through that, got back in the ice playing recreation hockey. And then, you know, he just wouldn't give up. And he got married, had twin boys, and had a second double lung transplant. And he almost passed away then too, and we lost him last year at age about 40. Still got had two kids, but he overcame so much, and it was such an inspiration because he just wouldn't quit. And so that's probably one of the most outstanding. And some other guys, we ran a hockey school one time in Gander, and a boy came out on the ice with goalie pads on and steel-toed boots. He had cerebral palsy, and he wasn't going to let that hold him back. So he learned to play goaltending. So I got him over in the summer, and he stayed with Lois and I, and got through the week. And he's doing really well now as an adult. And so those are the ones that really stand out. You know, I guess tell you a lot about some of those kids that came, and you know, it's wonderful to see them play pro hockey or get scholarships. But you know, when you look at courage, that to me, that's one thing I look up to. I look up to those kinds of kids and get a lot of inspiration from them.
And your Your biggest kind of mantra too has been to dream big. And even your license plate, I remember being able to pull up and see your purple truck with the license plate on the back saying "Dream Big." And I think that kind of resonates with every student that goes through you, because that's what you're preaching from day one of going through the camp, is to dream big and dream beyond hockey. So, and it's pretty clear in those stories that you share that people dream much bigger than maybe that their reality, but it's always important to do that.
And then to have the dream after the dream, like Scott Campbell is a family doctor now, and he went away on a scholarship to a school, a U.S. Prep school, and he sort of realized after that he wasn't going to make it as hockey, so he went into medicine. And he's back coaching now. He has a son that plays. And those are things that really mean a lot to me, because the hockey career only lasts so long. And Brett McClellan was another boy. He was drafted by Chicago, but he wasn't signed. And so he said, you know, I spent all these years learning to play hockey and chasing this dream. Now I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to put everything I have in studying medicine. And he did that, and he's a specialist now. And so those kinds of stories are really, really important. And people that hockey players are pretty neat people. They tend to share their wealth in many ways if they play pro. They're giving to the community, and we normally have a benefit game in the summer, and if you ask them, they'll all come play. And you know, I asked Al McAdam last year if he'd come and help coach her 2 years ago, and he said yeah. I said what time you want me there? And you know, they're always ready to come and pitch in. And Mike Kelly, all those guys.
So Sam touched on this a moment earlier. The program is much bigger than just athleticism, and you've got a great curriculum. You know, I can see students develop during the time that they're with you for a week or multiple weeks. They improve quite a bit. But the thing that I'm most impressed with as a parent is how you're creating citizens. And you're using that through the vehicle of athletics and hockey in this case to create people that, as you mentioned, that they're going to have a plan B. Not everybody's going to play hockey for their career. But I'm really impressed with how, you know, and my wife mentioned this one day, where one of the first sessions we came to with her kids, all these young children, Adam, Pee-wee, are holding the door open for people. You don't see that anyplace else in culture. You did see it, you know, around the Andrews Hockey Growth Program. Tell us a little bit about why that's so important to you beyond just the sports aspect and how you instill that in kids, because it's very clear it's an important part of the program.
Well, you have to care about kids, and you have to understand how bright they are. And I have an education background, and as I said, kids are so under-challenged that they're just not challenged. And I had my 8-year-olds this year. They were novice. They read Make Your Bed by Admiral William McRaven, a Navy SEAL, and the importance of doing something positive at the first of the day. And then they not only had the book, they had to follow through. And so I made the request, so I had to make my bed every day too. And Lois loves me for that. And then they read a totally awesome business book for kids by Arthur Bauchner, and they learned business skills, and many times they start their own business, and they learn to reach out to the community make sure that somebody in the community benefits from their the efforts, and so they become, once you start giving, then your life changes. And when we get together and I teach them, and then they teach. So they're given the chance to do that. And of course we really stress the importance of giving and putting someone else ahead of themselves and respect and all those things. And we're very consistent, as you know. I treat them all the same. If they don't pass the puck, they set a shift. And if they're staying on too long, they set a shift. Those are things that they can control. They can make as many mistakes as they like, and that's okay. But there's things they can control. They have to learn, so we don't make any favorites. We love them all, and we treat them all the same. And they're bright. I have a friend, one of my mentors out west, Wally Kosak, who's been with the Hockey Canada program for years. He's on his own now, but he says you don't look to see how smart a child is, you look to see how a child is smart, because they're all bright in different ways. So you find out where they're bright and then what their gifts are, and you try to build on that and have fun. They want to have fun, for sure.
That's certainly an overlying kind of aspect of hockey, obviously, is to have fun, but a lot of hockey skills I find translate into, whether it's the business world or even life in general, whether it's teamwork or work ethic is probably the biggest one, because if you aren't going to work hard in practice or in a game, then obviously it translates into your life and you maybe aren't as hard as a worker as you could be. But I think the skills that from sports in general, but especially hockey, that you can translate into life, it only helps a person grow, and especially at a young age, if they can go from not having those kind of skills and then eventually grow into a better communicator, a better leader, and a harder worker, it's only going to benefit them down the road.
Yeah, for sure, Sam. You're teaching me now, and that's pretty exciting.
So, Alan, in 44 decades that you've been kind of at this formally, what are some of the biggest challenges that you've encountered? And I think this season with COVID is probably one of the biggest, but what are some hurdles that you've overcome as you've kind of grown this organization to where it is today?
Obviously, our goal has always been to make enough money to pay the staff and to get another year. And sometimes it's been tough. And Lois and I had to make a lot of sacrifices initially in the first 10, 15 years to keep it going. This year, obviously, we're still not sure what's happening or what's going to happen. We're trying to prepare for everything. However, that's difficult right now because we're not sure what all the guidelines are going to be.
I guess to touch further, Alan, you're a very selfless person, so you always want to focus on other people, not yourself. But this time last year, you had a pretty big award given to you. You were honored with the Order of Canada. So do you want to maybe describe what that process was like?
Well, I got a call out of the blue from the lady in Ottawa, and I think I hung up on her a couple of times because I thought it was a telemarketer. And finally, when I talked to her and she told me about the Order of Canada, I guess possibly I thought, oh, this really is. So anyway, Lois and I went out west, and I didn't think about much about it. I said, sure, yeah, okay. And because I had no previous, warning about this. And so we went out west and we were coming back. And I said to Lois, I said, you didn't send it. You didn't give her our visa, that lady that called my mother, did you? And then we, when I got off the plane, this people congratulated me. They heard it before I did. So anyway, that was it. It wasn't something I was looking for, and I'm sure there was many, many, many people that deserved it more. But you're always thankful for something like that. And some of my family were able to come to Ottawa at the same time, so that was nice.
I think it's just a testament of what the program you've built and the people you've touched over the years. And certainly from my perspective, I can see how it was a no-brainer for you to be awarded something like that. And now you're definitely on an alumni list of everyone who does have the Order of Canada. You definitely made a mark, and you're able to proudly show that.
Well, I appreciate you bringing it up, Sam. I don't think about it very much, really. I'm always I'm excited, and I miss the kids because I had a great little team, and we were doing a lot of great things. And obviously, we had to quit; couldn't get through the spring. And they made a video for me and all said something, and that was very, very special to me. That was probably more important than anything. And they all made a little speech and showed what they were doing, and it was pretty neat to get that, because I learned a lot about each one of them from just what they said and how they acted and how they responded. We surrounded ourselves with some pretty neat people, and as far as the family goes, it was a family business, and it never occurred to me that I was starting a business, and so it was a necessity to learn business skills, and I'm still reading. I'm reading a book now by Dr. John Maxwell called No Limits, and I read this one by Dave Ramsey, the Entre Leadership. And another great one is the Business of the 21st Century by Robert Kiyosaki, and so I try to keep learning, keep getting better. Josh is a real student. He reads a lot of books. He listens to a lot of audio books, and he's done that for years and years and years. So we try to lead by example as far as personal growth goes, because you can learn at any age, obviously. And the older you get, the more you realize you don't know, a whole lot, and you got to keep learning.
So it sounds like you're a part-time librarian too, with all the books you got on deck.
Yeah, we have a lot of books, and I've read a lot of them, and I still reread some, but there's a lot that there's a lot to know, and. There's a lot to know outside of hockey, because it's a people business, and any business that you're in and what you guys are doing is so important, because you're in the business world, and you're communicating with people, and people want to know you care, and they want to know they want to be listened to, no matter if it's sports or business, and they want to be made feel important. So I think in anything we try to do, that if we can teach the people that come to our programs, that if they reach out to other people and make the relationships more about the other person rather than themselves, then they can achieve a lot more success than when it's all about yourself. And they learn that young, and it carries over with them. And it's amazing when they come back, they appreciate the fact that they've been encouraged, because I think one of the things in my life was, I can remember I was brought up on an old farm with no electricity or running water and like that. And anybody that was nice to me, it was amazing that how much it did for me, even if they just were nice to me or smiled at me. And I know the importance of just telling somebody they can achieve something, or smiling at them and telling them you're looking great today or whatever. It doesn't cost much to be nice to people.
It's very true. It's a good lesson. And I think what I got from a lot of the hockey camps and stuff is that to be successful in anything, you have to be a continuous learner. You have to always be evolving and always learning new things. And I remember the first or second year at hockey camp, I walked into a seminar room, and you were at the front, and then you had this massive table of probably 100 books. And I was like, good Lord, I can never read this many books. But as an 8-year-old, you think that, but I think it shows that you are a constant learner, and you're continuously learning new things and continuously evolving your strategy and adapting to the situations. So that's another lesson I've learned from you, I suppose.
Well, you know what? It's pretty amazing that you guys are doing great things with your lives. And Blake, I remember you vividly. You're one of the people that your dad brought you, and your brother, and your father was so nice. And I remembered you. You come more than a few times because you're pretty strong in my memory. And to see what you're doing now, and to follow what you do in your write-ups and your tweets and everything, it's pretty gratifying for me to know that I know you, and that I can learn from you, and that I can look up to you as well. And Sam, you're I don't know if you know how far you can go, because you're very bright and you got a great personality, and my Joshua feels the same about you. So those things are really important.
And I think even just to touch on the last part about how being nice to someone or giving someone that boost all the way through even junior high and high school, every time I saw you're saying keep doing great things, or you'd see that I won some sort of award or something, you'd say, wow, like, congratulations, Sam, the sky's the limit. And I think that kind of, obviously we didn't see each other as often as we used to, but it was that little push to say, okay, well, if someone like Alan or Josh or whoever can say that, then they're right. I can keep going and keep finding new things or keep finding new heights. So I appreciate that very much.
Oh yeah, you're a world beater there, Sam, and I expect great, great things from you. And it's such a privilege to be able to be interviewed by you. And I had a friend, and he's a sports writer, and he has a program, and he interviewed this guy and sent me the interview. And it was a guy by the name of Ken Dobson, who came as a hockey player from the St. John area and didn't have much skill. But he went out, and Dave Tucker Flanagan was his coach and is one of his instructors. And Dave was so nice to him that he came back the next year. His father figured he wouldn't play any more than 1 year, but Dave was so nice to him that he said, you know what, I stayed in hockey because of how nice Dave Flanagan was to me. He said, and then he got involved coaching and being on probably New Brunswick executives and all those kinds of things. But it was people like instructors like Dave Flanagan and all those guys that worked with us that really made a difference in the lives of so many people just by caring about them. Even in the game that his father came to watch him at the end of the week, he didn't do very well because he wasn't a great skater at the time. But he kept doing it because of the way he was treated by one of our staff. So I sent the interview to Dave, to Tucker, and he was pleased to hear it. And I had a chance to say some great things to him.
Yeah, David, sure. He is for a successful hockey player, he's certainly a nice, gentle, genuine kind of guy. But we've heard your name a number of times, and Sam and I have had the opportunity to talk to lots of Islanders on different subjects. And we did have the pleasure of interviewing Doug McLean a few weeks back, and he spoke very highly of what you've done for hockey and the contributions that you've made. So you go to the highest levels of the NHL, and I've seen lots of pictures of Sidney Crosby and some very successful hockey players around your program, but you've had a real impact from the highest levels down to guys like me that could skate and that was about it, but enjoy the game and can still hold a stick.
Well, Doug McLean is a pretty kind guy, and actually he started the hockey school the same time as I did, and we sort of worked with each other. And then when he coached the Western Capitals, for the first 2 years, I was a skating coach and technical advisor, and I was there to teach him, but I actually learned more from him than he learned from me. But we've been very good friends ever since, and I have a ton of respect for for Doug, who's done just about everything. And he's not afraid. He thinks a lot of everybody. He doesn't make any. He came down this year in a bad ice, sort of an ice storm, to Georgetown to watch a game of hockey. And he and his son Clark and Thomas McPhee, probably one of the best players that ever came to our program. He was playing, so Doug wanted to see him play. So they came down, and actually the World Junior final was on during that afternoon when they drove to Georgetown in the icy day and whatever. But that tells you what kind of person Doug McLean is.
And Alan, if you were to look out, let's say 20 years down the road, what do you envision the Anders program to be 10 years out, 20 years out? Where do you think, because it's gone a long way in 40 years, where do you think this is going to be in 10 years, 20 years from now?
Well, there's been a lot of changes, and we're doing a lot of things online now, and obviously this virus may force us to do more, but we're preparing to do online programs, and we have numerous online programs, and I'm not sure where the education system is going to go, because I think a lot of people now are realizing the kids are learning what they learn in school. They learn in a couple of hours in the morning, and they're doing some other things during the day, like working with their dads who are fishermen or farmers or whatever, and doing a lot of things that they didn't do before. And so I think that there's going to be a big shift in education. So it's going to create a lot of need to do more things online. We do satellite schools now. We do them in, last year we did them in Switzerland and Norway and Calouette and numerous places. We had a sold out hockey school a couple years ago with New York Islanders, but we couldn't get across the border. There wasn't, it wasn't possible for us to work through the red tape to get there. And so those things are, I think, going to be more and more prevalent in our programs, where we send out staff to other places, and so we're trying to prepare for all those. And Josh and Brad and those guys now are trying to figure out what's going to happen this summer. How do we stay effective and still focus on all of the values that we want to teach the kids, as well as the hockey skills, So there's going to be some massive changes, not just in our programs, but in a lot of programs in the future.
Well, Alan, I think, on behalf of all the students who've gone through your program, including Sam and I and the kids who are still going through the program, you've had a real substantial impact, not only on the athletics component, but certainly on the impact of the citizens that you've produced. And there's not many places I've encountered, including the public school system, where you can get exposure to some of the life lessons that you get in a week's impact between you and Josh and the whole team. It's a quite an amazingly run organization. And, I hope you recognize the impact that you have had on all the thousands of kids who've come through your program, and now the young professionals that are, in the community. So it's pretty amazing. Yeah. I don't know if you get...
Well, this has been a pretty unbelievable experience to speak to you guys and to know that I know both of you and to be reacquainted, because obviously when there's years between the time you spent with us and what you're doing now, it's great to get caught up as well and to keep watching you doing great things with your life.
And we'll keep watching the Anders Growth Program continue to grow. And look forward to what the next 10 years are going to bring.
And we'll keep watching you guys, too. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks, Leanne, for your time. So there was our interview earlier this week with Mr. Alan Andrews, the founder of Andrews Hockey Growth, probably the most known hockey school in all of North America, I would say, Blake, if you would agree.
Yeah, I mean, he started, there's been other people that have had programs. I think Alan in the interview even mentioned that Doug McLean had a program at a similar time, but I mean, what he's done and how he's grown it and how he's expanded and how other people have adapted to what he's accomplished is a testament to the strength of the program that he's built. And it's, you know, it's a big employer. It's a significant business. It's a big contributor to DEI. So it was great to have him on. I know he's impacted both of us. Me, not so much in my hockey career, but maybe other dimensions. But I did participate early on, I guess 40 years ago, probably. So I did not make it to Eastern Conference Finals in the NHL. I think you probably have achieved more in your hockey profession, but it's a great, great thing to participate in.
Definitely. So that will lead us into next week's guest. We're going to go back to one day a week. I know during COVID, we kind of put out a lot more content than probably people were ready for. But now that things are opening up and people are spending more time outside, I figure maybe not flood your airwaves with our voices, but to the one day a week, likely every Thursday from now on, we'll keep that going. Next week, Blake, do you want to talk about a little bit about our guest?
Yeah, and Sam, we're going to need more time because of this 75% discount off our recruitment services. We're going to be much busier. So I think once a week is probably the right mix. So next week, we've had some great people, great political reporters. We had Teresa Wright on earlier in the program. With the legislature opening up, we wanted to have somebody come in and bring perspective on what's happening politically. And I'm really delighted to have Guardian political reporter Stu Neatby. He's going to join us, and he's going to have some perspectives on what's happening, what to look forward to in the legislature, what we can expect to happen in this session. Is the era of collaboration starting to wane a little bit? It would certainly seem as though, you know, at least from one political party's perspective, they've declared that era is over. From the opposition party, I think they're certainly seeing a little bit more feisty. And I think the House will be a different environment this session, and everybody's got more comfort. Even though they've only had 8 days, they've had a year now to kind of acclimatize to this new relationship. So, yeah, Stu will be great to have on. You follow Stu in the legislature. What are your thoughts, Sam?
Yeah, Stu is a very straightforward. He doesn't really kind of muddy the waters in terms of politics. He's very straightforward. Always tells like how he sees it. I think the Guardian's always been blessed with that, to have, like, even before him, Teresa Wright was always someone who could tell exactly what she sees, he or she sees, and they're able to get the news out to people. Just to touch on that before, I don't want to go rambling because I could talk all day about political maybe.
Next week we'll have a chance to.
But yeah, exactly. But the biggest thing, I think people forget after election that, yes, the current leader or the current government's doing great, but that 1 year, after the election, they really can't do anything wrong. So people forget that after the last election in 2015, Wade McLaughlin and the Liberals, they were untouched for the first year. Their polling numbers were 65%. But then obviously after that 1 year, things start to diminish a bit, and the collaboration, so-called, will do it. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Greens come out shortly, and they've declared it before, they're not going to be collaborative if there's nothing to be collaborative with. So I would say this session might be a little bit different due to the pandemic, but moving forward, there's going to be a lot more dirt thrown, I think. And since it's a minority government, we could see an election within a year.
So you think the honeymoon period's over, Sam?
I do think so. And I think that's clearly evident with all the backlash of their announcement about the cottage or the non-residents being allowed to come and stay in their second residence.
But in general, what are your thoughts? Has the government done a good job administering this COVID crisis? I don't think anybody could have, you couldn't have anticipated
no,
it.
No, and like,
could you have done better?
I wouldn't switch seats for them for all the money in the world. They look like a lot of the decisions they're making are common sense and look good. But the idea of 24/7, 360, not 365, but the last 10 weeks has been 24/7. Your brain would never turn off. All right, what are we going to do tomorrow to make that we can help people? What are we going to do? Who do we forget? Who are we going to touch on? What professional should we ask? Where's the science saying? So obviously they're doing the best they can. And I think overall they've done a good job. Just yesterday might've had a little bit of a hiccup.
Well, and they've certainly dominated the airwaves, and that's a benefit when you're in power to control that narrative. So I think they've done a good job. They have announced some pretty progressive programs, both federal and provincial. I mean, both leaders now and key ministers have gotten a lot of airtime, and that's not by accident. You think maybe they've overdone it, Sam? Is there fatigue?
I think that's what we're seeing. That's maybe why yesterday happens, because the staff and the premier's office and the cabinet ministers, they probably are tired. I would be tired too if you were working constantly the past 10 weeks. But we'll see what happens. And I obviously sympathize with them because they all have families. They're all people, but they chose to be an elected official and they chose to do the job of the people. And obviously we can't predict a pandemic happening, but it's on the list of what could happen. So
you've seen one little backlash here and one announcement. They said 50 announcements. The rest have all been positively received. I think the real test is going to come, maybe July 1st. Let's see what happens for the next 30 days. Let's see how this reintroduction to the economy goes. I'm concerned, can restaurateurs be profitable at 50% capacity? Can retailers service their customers and compete with online retailers in these, constrained environments? I think that's where, if there's going to be friction, that might be where it comes. I think this is a blip for sure. Maybe it's a misstep. We'll let their PR team manage that. But I think a reflection after the legislature closes 1st of July, that's going to be a really important test for how people have, how people feel about government managing through this crisis.
Yeah, and we will analyze and pick apart as the weeks go on. And I'm sure we'll see, like you said, it'll depend on what happens the next step after phase two goes in and after phase three. And then maybe there'll be a phase four, I don't know. But we're certainly entering a new normal that we won't be going back to the way it always was. There's already a culture shift. I'm sure there's companies changing their ideas and governments change, obviously have changed their working from home policy. So we will see, and we will discuss it as time goes on.
But we're a phase, the exchange is a phase zero company. We were not interrupted by COVID. We not only progressed, but we expanded, adapted, and pumped out content with some great guests. So phase zero, we're looking forward to phase five. And I guess that's post viral remediation, some kind of vaccine.
Yep. And we will continue to uncover or talk about whatever happens to be in the news that week. But this has been another edition of The Exchange presented by Confederation Group. We thank you for listening as always, and we will see you next week.